Hudson Taylor, missionary to China. Some call him an apostle to China. One of the greatest missionaries of all time. Hudson Taylor's father, James Taylor, knelt before the birth of his son beside his 24-year-old wife, Amelia, in the parlor at the back of his busy chemist shop in Yorkshire, England, and he prayed, "Dear Lord, if you should give us a son, grant that he may work for you in China." How's that for a prayer before the birth of a child? Setting aside a child, like Hannah, receiving from the Lord her Samuel, giving him back unto the Lord. And here, before the child's even born, praying that he would be a missionary in China. By age 4, Hudson Taylor would declare, "When I'm a man, I mean to be a missionary and go to China." By age 4, he had also learnt the Hebrew alphabet. Hudson Taylor was home educated and grew up in a godly home. However, by age 17, he was severely backslidden. He was restless. He was rebellious against his parents. In June 1849, when he was 17, his mother locked herself in a room 50 miles from where Hudson Taylor was and determined to pray that her son would become a Christian, that she would not leave the room until she was sure that her prayers had been answered. How's that for prevailing and travailing in prayer? That same afternoon, Hudson Taylor picked up a gospel tract and was struck by the phrase, "the finished work of Christ." Light was flashed into my soul by the Holy Spirit. There was nothing to be done but to fall down on my knees and pray for salvation. As he rushed breathlessly home to tell his mother how he had been born again, she interrupted and said, "She already knew." How's that for mothers? Come across. Mothers often know before you can even tell them. Hudson Taylor wrote of the intense longing for God that gripped him. "From that time, the conviction never left me that I was called to China." Immediately began to prepare himself by studying Chinese through a copy of Luke's gospel that he had in Mandarin. He denied himself comforts and imposed disciplines on himself to prepare himself for the mission field. He undertook work amongst the poor and the sick, and he read avidly on China. He also threw himself into studying Latin, Greek, theology, and medicine. Hudson Taylor immersed himself in the Bible and prayer, including an entire night of intense prayer. One word came to characterize Hudson Taylor: faith. He determined to trust in God alone for all his needs. He loved to give to God, so tithing was soon left far behind as he gave away 2/3 of his income. His maxim became, "See if you can do without." His concern for China grew into an overwhelming burden, and he felt as though Christ's compassion for the multitude was flooding his soul. It was just overwhelming. Meeting a missionary to China, Hudson excitedly told him of his plans. But this missionary discouraged him, telling him the Chinese would never receive him on account of his fair hair. Later, while trying to dye his hair black, Hudson was injured and almost blinded when the ammonia mixture exploded the glass bottle it was mixed in. I think when you mix it, you meant to leave the top off, but he had a batoon. Very fortunate he didn't get blinded. In 1853, as the Taiping Rebellion broke out, Hudson Taylor, just 21 years old, said an emotional goodbye to his mother and sailed from England. The journey took 6 months by sea. Can you imagine 6 months travel by sea? And we're talking about, you know, sailing vessels. It included a severe storm, and storms toss you around. You don't want to be seasick. And when he arrived in the China at war. By the time Hudson Taylor landed in Shanghai in 1854, the rebels held the city. 50,000 imperial soldiers besieged it. Horrific sights and sounds greeted them. China was passing through an immense upheaval. There were several major uprisings in China in the 1850s and 1860s, two of them resulted in 25 million dead. Imagine a population like that wiped out in just a matter of years. Another 10 million died in a famine that stretched from 1877 to 1879 in the north of the country. 10 million died from one famine. There were also wars between Britain and China and France and Russia and Japan and China, and it hardly seemed to be the time to launch a new mission into China with explosions all around. But Hudson Taylor was gripped by the fact that 380 million people in the vast interior of China had never seen a Westerner, nor even heard the name of Christ. and he determined to change it. The house that Hudson was staying in Shanghai was struck by gunfire. The house next to his was destroyed by cannon fire. Nevertheless, he gave himself to the study of the language, to evangelism, and to helping the victims of the war. During these fearsome upheavals, Hudson traveled to take the gospel to previously unevangelized areas. One of these journeys was a 200-mile journey up the Yangtze River, and he frequently witnessed people being beheaded, and he himself came very close to being lynched on occasion. It was during this time that Hudson developed a brief but deep friendship with William Chalmers Burns, and they determined together to adopt Chinese dress. Burns and Taylor were men of one heart and one mind. They stayed at Swatow, a center of the opium trade, and the most wicked place imaginable. Burns was taken prisoner during the time in Swatow. Hudson Taylor's decision to shave his head and adopt a Chinese dress was rooted in his deep respect for the Chinese culture and his view of the role of the missionary. Many Chinese objected to Christianity, argued, because it seemed to be a foreign religion. His decision to go native, as they said, was greeted with derision and contempt by most of the Westerners. Well, for his part, Hudson Taylor thought that many of the missionaries to China were worldly, lacking in direction, and ineffective, which was sadly probably true. Hudson Taylor, whose proposals for marriage had already been rejected by two women in England, then met and courted a missionary teacher, Maria Dyer, the much sought after 20-year-old daughter of prestigious missionary parents. The missionary establishment was horrified that this unsophisticated missionary, who had gone native wearing Chinese dress, and they opposed the marriage, of course. However, Maria showed herself to be of equal dedication to Hudson Taylor, and on the 20th of January, 1858, Hudson Taylor and Maria Dyer became husband and wife, and it was to be an uncommonly happy marriage, largely because they shared the same deep passion to evangelize China at great personal sacrifice. From the start, they were frequently in danger. And the first child, Grace, was born with a riot raging outside. Hudson Taylor's missionary partner, Dr. Parker, who had opened up a clinic at Ningpo, was compelled to return to Scotland when his wife died. You see this picture here, it's got an X marked by that window. That's because that was the Taylor's residence, and that was a back window where they had a rope ladder ready that if they were attacked at the front, they could put the rope ladder down the back to escape a Chinese mob attacking them. And that was the kind of contingency plans they needed to make. With supplies dwindling and Hudson Taylor's health deteriorating, he had to make the painful decision to close the medical clinic and return to England. There he was to remain for 6 years. But this temporary retreat proved to be the precursor to a great missionary advance. His burden for inland China was becoming overwhelming, and the only relief he could find was in prayer and in the Word of God. First, earnest prayer to God to thrust forth laborers, and second, the deepening of the spiritual life of the church so that men should be unable to stay at home. This is what he wrote. In 1865, Hudson Taylor dictated a book, China, Its Spiritual Need and Claims to Maria, while he restlessly paced up and down the floor. One paragraph declared, "Can all the Christians of England sit still with folded arms while the multitudes in China are perishing? Perishing for lack of knowledge. The lack of that knowledge which England possesses so richly, which has made England what England is, made us what we are. What does the Master teach us? Is it not that if one sheep out of 100 be lost, we're to leave the 99 and seek that one? But yet the proportions are almost reversed. We stay at home with the one sheep and take no heed to the 99 perishing ones." Hudson Taylor knew that a new missionary organization dedicated to the evangelization of inland China was needed. At this point, he found himself racked with doubt, and he rarely slept for 2 hours at a time. Now, you understand that up till now, the great missionary movement launched by William Carey tended to be reaching coastal regions, which made sense. It's a place you could reach by boat, and it's where there were some European settlements and where they might have access to printing presses. And so the first great wave of missionary service was mainly the coastal areas. But what Hudson Taylor launched was the second great phase, the inland missions. China Inland Mission, Sudan Interior Mission, Africa Inland Mission, and so on, came out of his view of we need to aim at the interiors. He agonized over the desperate spiritual plight of China and with what he called his unbelief. Strange thinking, a man who epitomizes faith, battled with unbelief. He feared taking responsibility for sending young men and women into the interior of China where they would be subject to rejection, illness, and severe persecution, maybe even martyrdom. He thought that he was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. He wrote, "For 2 or 3 months, intense conflict. I thought I should lose my mind." One Sunday morning, he slipped out of church after worship, unable to bear the sight of a congregation of 1,000 or more Christian people rejoicing in their own security, while millions are perishing for lack of knowledge. He wrote that he wandered out in the sands of Brighton Beach alone in great spiritual agony. This, by the way, is one of the evangelistic tracts he had designed, which is explained the way of salvation to Chinese people. But during this prayer walk, the Lord conquered my unbelief, and I surrendered myself to God for this service. I told him that all responsibility must rest with him, that as a servant, it was mine to obey and to follow him. It was his to direct, to care for, and to guide me and those who might labor with me. Immediately he wrote in the margin of his Bible, prayed for 24 willing, skillful laborers. Brighton, June 25, 1865. The China Inland Mission that Hudson was now planning to launch was innovative and was radical for that time. Hudson Taylor launched the first truly interdenominational faith mission. So while William Carey launched the modern missionary movement, he launched denominational missions, Baptist missions, and then it was followed by Anglican missions, Congregational missions, and so on. They were all denominational missions, and were mostly focused on the coastal areas. Hudson Taylor now launched interdenominational faith missions for the interior. This is the second wave of the great modern missionary movement. From the first, Hudson Taylor determined that the China Inland Mission would have 6 distinctive features, quite radical for their time. Number one, its missionaries would be drawn from any denomination, provided they would sign its evangelical Protestant doctrinal statement. Number two, CIA missionaries would receive no salaries but trust in the Lord to supply their needs. Income would be shared and no debts would be incurred. Number three, no appeals for funds would be made. They might make needs known, but they would not do any fundraising. Number four, the work abroad would not be directed by a home committee, but by himself and eventually other leaders in the field in China. You see, the mission that William Carey launched was run from London. And in fact, they later kicked him out over controversies. I think he learned from this and said, you can't have missions in the field run by bureaucrats back at home. It's got to be run by the people taking the risks in the field who are aware of the peculiar situations and challenges on the ground. Number five, the organization would press on into the interior of China where Christ has not been named. In other words, focus on unreached people's areas, resistant areas, the most needy areas. Number six, the missionaries would wear Chinese clothing and worship in Chinese-style buildings. In addition, China Inland Mission would use lay workers rather than ordained ministers. It would even accept single women as missionaries. For the time, all this was radical. If this doesn't sound radical to you, then you don't understand what it was like back then. And it just shows how successful he's been, because many of these principles are now accepted by many missions today. Within the year, Hudson and Maria Taylor and their 4 children set sail for China with 16 young missionaries on board. Soon there were 24 China Inland Mission missionaries in China. God's blessings on this new enterprise were soon evident, with 20 of the ship's crew making commitments to Christ during the voyage. How's that for bonus? You haven't even reached the field yet and you're winning sailors for Christ. But within the year, the mission was engulfed in opposition and dissension and controversy and fire and death. In 1867, the Taylor's daughter Grace died. Their mission house in Yangzhou was attacked and set on fire. Furious persecution engulfed them. As Hudson Taylor wrote, "If the Spirit of God works mightily, we may be sure that the spirit of evil will also be active." You've got to expect it. In fact, in the military we say, if the enemy is within range, so are you. And that's also true in sword fighting. If you can reach the enemy, he can reach you. And so you've got to expect that if you are making an impact on Satan's kingdom, if you are plundering hell, if you are winning souls for Christ, expect opposition. In fact, as my missionary mentor, Francis Grimm, said in Hospital Christian Fellowship, if you're not being criticized, you're not doing your job. Undeterred, Hudson Taylor treated more than 200 patients a day. Can you imagine? With one of his converts, too, preaching to those waiting for medical treatment, Hudson Taylor made enormous demands on himself and he expected equally high standards from his CIM missionaries. One of his new missionaries, Louis Nickel, you can spot the smug character over here. He's third from the left on the bottom sitting, but Louis Nickel. He grew increasingly bitter and resentful of Taylor's style of leadership, and he spent his time visiting other missionaries and grumbling, whinging, whining, backstabbing, and creating dissension. Louis Nickel soon abandoned the Chinese dress, claiming that English clothes gave him more protection and respect. I will not be bound neck and heel to any man, he declared. After nearly 2 years of unpleasantness and disruption, Hudson Taylor regretfully had to dismiss Nickel from the mission, mainly for unrelenting slander and lies. Three CIM missionaries resigned in sympathy with Nickel. At around the same time, two other CIM missionaries complained it was dangerous for so many unmarried women and men to live together at New Lane, the CIM headquarters in China. They accused Hudson Taylor of being too familiar with the young ladies because Hudson and Maria kissed some of the girls on the forehead before they went off to bed. Now, the ladies themselves denied that any appropriate, no behavior was being inappropriate, but still, the complaint reached London and for a time led to a fall in support for the mission. In spite of constant controversies, the number of CIM missionaries grew. In time, they became the largest mission organization in the world. By the end of the 19th century, China Inland Mission was the largest mission in the world. Then Timothy Richard, a Welsh Baptist, began to cause further divisions within CIM, arguing God also works through other religions, such as Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism. A handful of CIM missionaries were influenced by Richard's liberal views and left the mission. As Hudson began sending unmarried, single women into the interior, another storm of controversy and criticism erupted. How can you be sending single women into such dangerous terrain? The courage of these tenacious young pioneers cannot be exaggerated. Annie Royal Taylor, who, although she has the surname Taylor, was no relation to Hudson, as far as we know, one of the many bold individualists within CIM, set her sights on taking the gospel to the forbidden city of Lhasa in the heart of Tibet. That's the highest city in the world, right up there in the Himalayas. She adopted native Tibetan dress. She shaved her head in the fashion of a Tibetan nun. Bandits stole her tent, her clothing, killed most of her pack horses. Some of her workmen died, others turned back. One of her Chinese workers demanded more money, and when that was refused, he brought accusations against her to the Tibetan authorities, which led to her arrest. Annie Taylor finally established her own agency, the Tibetan Pioneer Mission, recruiting 14 missionaries to work with her. But in less than a year, all had left her, and the infant mission was in a shambles. However, Annie Taylor continued for more than 20 years working, mostly alone, in Tibet, one of the toughest, most resistant, difficult mission fields on the planet, all on her own. Hudson Taylor did not make any distinction between married and single women. He expected married women to focus primarily on the ministry, even as the single sisters did. To male recruits, Hudson Taylor declared, "Unless you intend your wife to be a true missionary, not merely a wife, homemaker, and friend for you, do not join us." Maria set the pace for the other married women in the mission, caring for 5 children and actively reaching out to Chinese women in daily outreach. In 1870, the Taylor's son Samuel died. Then their 5th son, Noel, died 2 weeks after being born. Then a few days later, Maria Taylor died at age 33. 4 of Maria's 8 children died before they could reach age 10. Hudson Taylor returned to England, married Jenny Faulding, and suffered an accident which left him with a damaged spine. But even while recovering and immobile, he refused to be idle. prayer and planning fill this time. China is not to be won for Christ by ease, loving, quiet men and women. The stamp of men and women we need is such as will put Jesus, China, and souls first and foremost in everything, at every time. Even life itself must be secondary. As somebody who had literally given all to China for Christ's work in China, he found impossible to expect any lesser commitment from others. Hudson Taylor was frequently accused of being demanding and autocratic, but in his mind, he was merely anxious to protect the integrity of the mission, to fulfill the Great Commission. In spite of constant poor health, regular bouts with depression, and a self-confessed irritation and impatience, he also could show tremendous flexibility and steadfastness under trial. All mission pioneers and leaders have this vision which drives them, and it makes it very hard to understand those who are half-hearted or who are indolent and who waste time, miss opportunities, resources, and so on. And so these are the kind of accusations thrown about just about every mission leader. Hudson and Jenny Taylor presented an incredible example of dedication. When they were bequeathed several thousand pounds, they gave it all to the mission. They were frequently separate from one another and engaged in demanding journeys and a relentless schedule of ministry. Very selfless, sacrificial individuals. Still, at the end of his life, Hudson Taylor could declare that the sun had never risen upon him in China without finding him at prayer. That's incredible to say, every single day. There was an urgency in everything that he did. He was a man of faith who stated that his life was based upon three facts. There is a living God. He has spoken in the Bible. He means what he says, and he will do all that he has promised. That's a pretty good foundation for any ministry. In a letter to his mother, Hudson Taylor described his own assessment of his life in these words. Envied of some, despised by many, hated perhaps by others, often blamed for things I never heard of or had nothing to do with, an innovator of what has become established rules of missionary practice. Now, that's the funniest thing of all. Many of his critics actually adopted many of his policies later and strategies. An opponent of mighty systems of heathen error and superstitions, working without precedent in many respects, and with few experienced helpers, often sick in body as well as perplexed in mind and embarrassed by circumstances. Here's another one, the evangelistic tracts, showing the broad way and the narrow way. Had not the Lord been specifically gracious to me, had not my mind been sustained by the conviction that this work is his, and that he is with me in it, in the thick of the conflict, I must have fainted and broken down. But the battle is the Lord's, and he will conquer. We may fail. We do fail continually. But he never fails. Indeed, by the end of his Hudson Taylor's life, the very mission organizations that had belittled and ridiculed his methods had begun adopting many of them, without accreditation, of course. By the time Hudson Taylor died, there were over 205 China Inland Mission stations, 849 missionaries, and 125,000 Chinese Christians in the congregations they had established. That is a phenomenal achievement against all odds. In 1900, there was the Boxer Rebellion. Many, many, many China Inland Missionaries were martyred in the Boxer Rebellion in 1900. But the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And today we know that there's something in the region of 140 million Christians in China. Can you imagine? By the time Hudson Taylor died, the Ministry of China Inland Mission grown. This is its headquarters in England. This was just one class of missionary recruits, a women's group being trained to go out to China. Hudson Taylor declared, God's man in God's place, doing God's will to God's glory, will never lack for God's support. The Great Commission is not an option to be considered, it is a command to be obeyed. These are words of Hudson Taylor. The text of what I have given tonight is one of the chapters in the Great Essential Missions, which is one of your handbooks. And we will have the audio and the video of this uploaded into our Frontline Mission SA.org website in due time. Any questions or comments on Hudson Taylor and the inland missions or the independent interdenominational faith missions, which even sent out single women into the field and lay people, which is massive innovations.
Given Hudson Taylor's medical background, did he and the China Inland Mission focus on a more medical ministry, so preaching the gospel?
They did. They saw that God had given the command to go and heal the sick and to preach the gospel. And so they saw that how do you reach people in places like China, where the people have very sophisticated superstitions and religious systems and idolatry, and believed that ministering to the body was the first step. Then you could minister their mind and then to their spirit. And so, yes, clinics were key. And it was interesting that the missionaries that he recruited, overwhelmingly he wanted them to be involved in medical work first. Medical work was, to them, one of the keys to reach China and to show their care for the people, their love for the people. And it's a powerful model. Of course, David Livingston followed that too. It's just an aside, but do you know that David Livingston was planning all along to be a missionary to China? When he was studying at a theological seminary, when he was studying medicine, his plan was to be a missionary to China. But when he was ready and he was ordained and graduated in 1840, the Opium War was on the go. Britain and China were at war. And so the door to China was closed. And at that moment, another London missionary, Saudi missionary, came through town, and that was Robert Moffat. And Robert Moffat spoke of the smoke of 1,000 villages in Africa that have not yet heard the gospel of Christ. And David Livingston providentially shifted his focus from Asia to Africa. And I praise God he did. I'm sure David Livingston would have done good in China, but he was made for Africa. David Livingston needed to come here, and it's hard to believe he could have been as effective in China as he was in Africa. So while I don't want to underestimate the importance of the work of winning Asia to Christ, but of course I am biased. My biggest vision is Africa for Christ. So interesting that David Livingston was, all through his studies, he was focused on China. And just by God's providence, he was redirected to Africa at the last minute. Yes.
Interesting. Hudson Taylor was the first missionary book that I read when I was younger. Than I went to my grandfather's cabinet, and then it was Hudson Taylor. It's like one of my favorite missionaries, actually. Like, it was so inspiring, and like a lot went on in that book. Really.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we've just scratched the surface. I hope that whet appetite to read more on Hudson Taylor. The missionary under whom I trained, Francis Grimm, he required everybody to read Hudson Taylor and C.T. Studd. Now, tomorrow night, I'll be dealing with C.T. Studd. Hudson Taylor and C.T. Studd were the two role models lifted up before Hospital Christian Fellowship that we were expected to follow. And how many times Francis Grimm would quote from Hudson Taylor or C.T. Studd, they were obviously the most inspiring missionaries for him. Any other... you can see there's a lot of books going through of Hudson Taylor's books, which are just absolutely tremendous. Yes.
It is encouraging if we take Hudson Taylor now and Kerry yesterday. Kerry's marriage and his situation with his wife sort of made his ministry more difficult and more challenging, I think. Well, his first wife, anyway.
Yes.
And with Hudson Taylor, the bond and the shared commitment made a huge difference.
There is no doubt that Hudson Taylor's ministry was immeasurably more effective by having a wife as committed as he was. Made all the difference. Marrying wisely is one of the most important things one can do. Your most important commitment is to Christ, and your second most important commitment is who you marry. Ministries are made or broken on those kind of decisions. Yes, I must say, William Carey must have had one of the worst marriages. But if you want to get a really bad example of how not to do it, you've got to look at John Wesley. John Wesley must get the prize for the worst a courtship model on the planet. What he did just boggles the brain. I don't want to get distracted from Hudson Taylor, but John Wesley, one of the greatest evangelists, he decided that because there was someone he was determined to marry who would have made a good match, everyone thought so, she loved him, he loved her, but he decided that God wouldn't want him to satisfy his own desires, so he rejected the person that he loved and he married someone he didn't love by drawing lots, and it was a catastrophic John Wesley, honestly, and I'm sorry to say George Whitefield didn't do much better. Those two, when it comes to marriages, they really made a mess of it. And John Wesley was so bad that he only found out his wife had died months later. He wasn't even at the funeral. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how out of touch he was. So John Wesley was... William Carey had a tragic marriage. John Wesley had a foolish marriage. But praise God for people like Hudson Taylor who show you that you can have good missionary marriages. And John, you were going to say.
Yes, I wanted to say in-house wars are the most difficult fights in missions, as we find that there were revolts people whom he had recommended to come into missions. Then we are backbiting him, fighting. So I'm saying, in a sense, it's better to fight somebody from outside than from within.
Yes.
And these things, they also do happen even in our churches, that wars within the church is a very difficult war to fight, rather than somebody coming from outside and then he wants to fight with us.
Yes.
It's better, I would appreciate that one. So I'm also feeling sorry for his experiences, especially for those missionaries who were revolting against him because of jealousy or because of differences.
Yeah.
Of course, we are all different.
Yeah.
We won't be the same. We need to tolerate one another.
And the point is, if you join a mission, you find their philosophy, their style, it's not mine. We're not prisoners. We can leave. But it doesn't have to be done in an ugly way. And I don't think one should ever hear any negative talk about people who've invested in our training and blessing. So, for example, before Frontline Fellowship, I worked for Scripture Union and I worked for Hospital Christian Fellowship. Those were my early Christian ministry experiences. Nobody will hear me saying anything bad against these ministries. They helped in training me, making me what I am. And how can I say anything but my gratitude for the example given and the opportunity given. But unfortunately, you have people who, when they leave something, they want to attack and burn and break down everything in that previous group. Now, I don't know why. Is it because they felt rebuked or challenged about something? Was it jealousy? What is it? I don't understand that mentality. But today, it's quite common to see people attacking the church they used to. Maybe the church had brought them to Christ. The church had discipled them. And next thing they're attacking them and they can't just... If they want to leave and start a different work, go and do so. But no, they want to attack the one before. And I've seen this, some of the greatest ministries on earth, attacked by people who, if they don't like it, leave. Start a better work. Do a better work. You know, show it up by doing a better job than the ones you're criticizing. But they don't tend to. It's easier to criticize and to break down and to actually build up, isn't it? But it's ungodly. Yes?
What are your comments on single male and female missionaries today?
Single what?
Single missionaries today.
Oh, you mean like where a person is just an independent missionary,
not part of
an organization? Or you mean unmarried?
Unmarried missionaries.
Okay, look, obviously there can be a place for unmarried missionaries, and we heard of the tragic story of Henry Martin, who really wanted to go into the field with his beloved, and she just wasn't interested. And that was a sad story. I mean, he died age 32, was it, en route to Arabia. So Henry Martin is sad. He didn't want to be single, but he wasn't willing to not go to the field. So I think, bearing in mind that the Lord sent out his disciples two by two, it's a good model. You read in Ecclesiastes, two is better than one. And there's no doubt that there's strength. When one is down, the other can lift them up and so on. Teamwork is good. And so in missions, we see some excellent teamwork. Robert Moffat and his wife Mary Moffat, very, very good team. And, of course, Hudson Taylor and his wife Maria, a superb team. So if we look at married missionaries who both committed, the work is without a doubt much, much, much more effective. We then have to think of what Martin Luther said. Reformer Martin Luther said, it is impossible for a man to remain single without sin. How's that for a categorical statement? Then you have the Puritans who taught that a man who refuses to marry, and later in life, and he continues to refuse to get married, and he's moving into his 30s and so on, he is as if he has shed innocent blood. Now the Puritans, these serious Calvinists, taught this because of the creation mandate. One of the first commands is to be fruitful and multiply. And so to refuse to, there's all the God seeks godly offspring. Remember the excellent message given by Mr. Catano last week. God seeks godly offspring. And so to refuse to do your part in producing godly family, bringing more godly children into the world, well, you're weakening the cause, there's no doubt. It's better to multiply to the church than to add to the church. And then you start to think of the damage done by people on their own. The Lord said in the garden, it is good, it is good, it is good. And then suddenly something was not good. And what was that? It is not good that man should be alone. So I think we need to get back to understanding some basic things there. So obviously there's a season. In my case, for example, I am married at 29, which was fairly late for people in the 80s. It's not as uncommon these days. And the reason was because I didn't know of anyone else willing to be as committed to the unique missionary calling, restricted access areas, persecuted church that I was. I mean, how many people want to have someone who's going into danger regularly as their husband? So in my case, it was a tremendous joy when I found someone who actually shared the same calling and vision and enthusiasm and who wouldn't hold me back. But then there's other people who act like there's no God-fearing, missionary-minded women in the world who are willing to make these sacrifices. And there are. I know many more missionary-minded, godly women than I know of godly, missionary-minded men willing to get married. So unfortunately, I think more and more men are getting married later and later or not at all. And I must say, there's a lot of reasons for it, but one of the reasons is feminism. The feminist movement has chased a lot of men away, and this war against males and this war against men and all men are trash, which is a campaign that just started up at UCT. You know, these things do not help. But then there's other things. The war against males, in so many ways, many males have just drifted away from responsibility and gone into gangs and drugs and computer games and whatever, and they're just completely away from responsibility. That's not healthy. But what's the problem with the Christian men? Why is it that Christian men are so loath to make commitments and to settle down and to raise a family? And I think it's not healthy. It's much better to have missionary couples. We're not Catholics. We don't believe in the unmarried celibate priesthoods. From the time Martin Luther has been pointing out in the Bible, it says that you cannot be a bishop unless you're the husband of one wife who has raised their children to respect you and fear the Lord. So that's a requirement for church leadership. And how can you be a very effective church leader if you haven't had responsibilities of raising a family? So there are arguments, but there's a place for young single missionaries for a time. I was, for quite a while, quite embarrassed about the fact that I'd go into the field and I'd I preached in a place, and you could see some people look at me because I looked awfully young in my 20s. And some people thought I was still at school. And I'd ask, how many children do you have? No, I don't have any children. How long have you been married? I'm not married yet. And you could see them sort of look at you like, and you're teaching us? And I mean, I remember seeing this Mozambican girl of the shock of the people, like, what are you even doing here? Why are we even listening to you? And unfortunately, you could see, while in the West, there's a deifying of youth and despising of old age. But in Africa and Asia, there's a respect for age. And in many cases, they actually despise youth. But it's more biblical to respect age, isn't it? Not. So I must say, there was quite a long time that I just felt so young, so inexperienced, and I regularly felt that these people look at me thinking, you're just a kid, you know, what have you got to tell us? And it was quite a surprise when one day I realized I was no longer the youngest around, but we do grow out of it if we survive.
Sorry, Corin. Talking about marriage, I noticed that youth today, I don't know, they're not really, well, I wouldn't say genuine, that's a bit judging, but like, for example, like the boys of today, and also because of today, like the boys of today, they don't have manners, and they're sloppy, and they, I don't know. And if you look at maybe 10 years back, they seemed almost better. So, I mean, like, for example, let's just talk about it. I walk into exam, okay? They look like they just got out of bed. Like, there's no self-respect at all. Same with the girls. It's just, I don't know, it's a bit depressing, actually.
It is. Well, I can think back a lot further than that. And let me tell you, 40 years ago, it was completely, completely different. And the reason is, we had military call-up. We were called up to military. We were drilled, and 5 o'clock PT every morning. We were doing press-ups in the rain. We were doing rock PT. We were doing fuss baits with poles and drums and tires, running for hours and hours and hours, 8.4 kilometer things in the pouring mud and rain, inspections every day, all the different. And the South African infantry training was intense. Of course, Rhodesia also had very intense training too. And the fact is, what we had with all young males having to go through this, we learned to respect authority, we learned to how to make our bed and how to be able to do everything from ironing, cleaning, fixing, so on. To this day, I can iron better than any domestic, and I can clean things cleaner than anyone else can. I know how to prepare it for commandant's inspection. And it taught young men to respect their mothers, their sisters, to prize their homes, and many to be desperate to get married as quick as they got out of the army. So I think there was just a whole different outlook, and it's such a pity we no longer have military service. The society's become much sloppier, superficial and shallow, and of course Hollywood doesn't help. It's made things even more selfish. So, yes, one of the solutions, I think, was we had military service, which really helped. They knocked sense into us. And we were... It's amazing that you could have these young men who could not clean up their room or make their bed. You give them to the Army Sergeant Major for a few weeks and they could make their bed so perfect. And I mean, the floor shone and everything was just perfect and just amazing how you could have this transformation. And they turned boys into men. And I still think it's a great thing and it's a wonderful thing. And I praise God, it did the world a good for me. And I'm sorry that the young people today don't have enough. Sorry, my sons haven't had the opportunity of going into an army where they had chaplains preaching the word of God, the fear of God, strong standards, and taught us.
It's good. Girls, like the men, you know, people expect them to go to the army. And
yes.
What they used to expect from us.
Well, I like the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides concept as Major General Baden-Powell designed it, which, by the way, was to design soldiers for the empire. I mean, that was his vision. Now, in the army, we did have a women's corps. It was obviously only volunteers. They were never conscripted. And we had a lot of women come to our mission who had been through the army women's training corps at George And they did very well. Of course, they were never trained for or put into combat. They were signals, administration, medics, and other important support troops to release more men for the field. But our women had gone to the army. They were great. And I remember my wife at one point turning to me and saying, "Don't talk to me like that. I'm not one of your frontline women who went through the army." I mean, they did have a different attitude, there's no doubt. They didn't mind being spoken to with harsh words. They didn't take it personally because that was how we were raised. And I'm continually astounded. Anthony says to me, he's just doesn't understand this young generation that can't take rebukes and corrections. Snowflakes. You take offense instead of taking correction. And it is a problem for us. I mean, my generation, we were shouted at, we were sworn at, we were screamed at, we were called all sorts of things. And, you know, it didn't do us any harm. It made us better, sharper, more focused, recognize things. And while I wouldn't recommend that sort of behavior, nevertheless, it didn't do me any harm. At school, I got caned. In the army, I got confined to barracks and rock PT and so on. In the fire brigade, we got extra drills cleaning the whole fire engines and things like this for infractions. It didn't do me any harm. So what? We got treated harshly. Actually, at Hospital Christian Fellowship, it was even stricter than that. But it only did me good. I don't count any of it as abusive. I count all of it as actually excellent because it made me better and stronger and able to survive. And I didn't pack up and fold up under fire or when imprisoned or arrested or interrogated or tortured or betrayed because we had good training. And why would we want to be weaker? Why not be stronger? So your question is, what can a woman do? Well, some could volunteer, but I'd say Girl Guides is a good start. But missionary service is even better because in missionary service, one has to be sacrificial giving. So if the men are conscripted and have to go to the army, how wonderful if a woman can devote themselves to either medical or missionary, other kind of sacrificial work. And of course, women are more naturally sacrificial and serving anyway, but they still need to be rescued from this shallow, superficial junk which today is destroying a generation. You know, this kind of where everything is the selfie generation and where they're shallow as anything. When Andrea went to America to a Christian college, she said, "Dad, you can't believe how shallow these girls are." I said, "They haven't even heard of Jane Austen. They don't know who Shakespeare or Dickens is. They don't read. They don't know any of the. They don't know who Mr. Darcy is. They don't know who Elizabeth Bennet is. You know, it's just like, what can you do with these people?" But they all know about the Spice Girls or whatever kind of, whatever the, you know, the modern cultures. And it is a pity. And the thing is, let's face it, depravity of man, which embraces women too, the depravity of men and women, we all need some good discipline and focus to get us out of being selfish and shallow and soft, sloppy and weak. So, yes, I would recommend, as we can't do military service these days, there's no God-fearing armies that I know of right now, missionary service to God, which is my plan that we launch, hopefully beginning of next year, Livingston Missionary School, where we can have a farm where we have full-on training for missions and medical and practical and agricultural and carpentry and everything necessary, that it would be same as the military training without the swearing and the abuse, with in a God-fearing environment where the scriptures, the foundations, so that at the end you've trained people who know how to fix vehicles, make things work, get water pumps going, do what's got to be done in the field and so on, and be able to evangelize and disciple. So that's my goal, somewhere where homeschooling families can send the young people where they will get something akin to the old military training, but missionary training. That's why we want to call it Livingston Missionary School, LMS.
So how long will the courses be there?
1 year.
1 year.
Yeah, I mean, that's the idea. Of course, in the army, we had a 2-year military service, but I think in 1 year, you can teach everything necessary, and I hope some would decide to stay longer, but 1 year is a good commitment. So instead of people having this gap year, where they sort of drift, having a gap year which prepares them for life. That's the goal. So, any other comments? On, as you can see, some of the books on Hudson Taylor. Any other comments?
That 99 sheep quote was really, because I think it's still true today.
But, you know, bear in mind, all the missionaries that I'm sharing with you, very politically incorrect. They offended people. They went against the selfish tide of the times. And what they said definitely angers some people. Some people just don't like it. But they were not interested with pleasing man. They were seriously interested in pleasing God. That's why I want to lift up these people. I'm trying to be honest and balanced, giving them the positive and the negative, the attractive and the maybe not so attractive. But I mean, this is the facts. These are people from another era who impacted the world far better than we are doing in our era. And we need to get more backbone and fire. Yes?
Now, I'm thinking again. If permanent missions long ago looked like going, establishing a mission base and working there, what does a permanent mission look like today?
Well, there are different mission models for this. And you've got to have mission bases in different places. Now, right here, this mission base is involved in a plethora of ministries, everything from book ministry, homeschool ministry, seminars, courses, camps, outreaches, short-term ministry, and so on. There are others who need to have other focuses. Now, from here, we have started schools, Bible colleges, clinics, hospitals, as far afield as Sudan. And I believe that it's good to have bases and to start other bases, but the bases we've started have normally been run by the local people, and we come in, we help them prepare. I think that you need to have a variety of skills depending on what the needs are. Now, for example, Sudan, we saw phenomenal church, well-organized, but they lacked Bibles, and then they needed medical equipment and so on and so forth, and there were things we could fill the gap, but we didn't have to replicate their church work. They had great churches, great leaders. We didn't have to do their work for them. We just had to come alongside, help them to get going, and then we could go and help in other places and still be their friends on call. When we've seen a place where there's nothing going, then we've started our own work. And in time, once it's ready, hand over to others. Like we've got a Bible college, Covenant College, started up in the eastern province of Zambia because they had no evangelical Bible college in the whole eastern province of Zambia. Jehovah's Witnesses were there. The Muslims were there. Witchcraft was there, so we started Bible College, and once it was up and running, after a few years, we graduated the first 3 years, graduates in Bible College, we hand over to local leaders, and it's continuing, and it's running well. Now, I mean, to me, those are some of the models. There's other models. You've seen, by going out to Morrison, Kwasa Bantu Mission, a farm model that is self-sufficient, and from there, they're operating as a base. In fact, as you've asked that, I'm going to show you a video on the Kwasa Bantu Mission in KwaZulu tomorrow to give you another model, a phenomenal model, probably the most successful model of modern missions in Africa.